Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to This Week in Oncology. I am your co-host, Greg Masters. And joining me today, as always, is my partner and inspiration for the series, Dr. Richard Just. Rich, are you there?
I'm here and glad to be here.
Absolutely. So happy you could make it. This program actually came together on a fairly last-minute notice. We had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Ronnie Zeiger this morning on This Week in Health Innovation, and it just so happens that he had a time this afternoon to reconvene, and we are just thrilled because we will get to chat with the co-founders of Smart Patients, Dr. Ronnie Zeiger and Jules Friedman. Smart Patients was recently previewed at TEDMed, which just concluded last week, is an online community where cancer patients and caregivers learn from each other about treatments, clinical trials, the latest science, and how it all fits into the context of their experience. Ronnie Zeiger, a.k.a. R-Z-E-I-G-E-R on Twitter, is well-known in the innovation space. He's the former chief Google health strategist, turned CEO of Smart Patients. He's also a practicing physician, father, husband, a forever student, and one who believes in the networks of micro-experts concept, and we'll hear more about that later. Gilles Friedman, also on Twitter at G-Fry, G-F-R-Y, is the visionary and rather passionate founder of the Association of Cancer Online Resources, ACOR. You can find Gilles' community, the community actually, at acor.org. Is a co-founder of Smart Patients as well. And ACOR is a free, unique collection of online cancer communities designed to provide timely and accurate information in a supportive environment. So I believe we've been joined by Dr. Zeiger. Ronnie, are you with us?
So, Ronnie, hi, this is Gilles speaking.
Hey, Gilles. Welcome.
And Ronnie will be joining us shortly and has asked me to start a conversation with you.
Wonderful. Okay, well, we will welcome him at when he arrives. So, with that as a general introduction and background, Rich, over to you.
Gilles, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I met you a couple of years ago, I think. Sorry?
I met you a couple of years ago.
Sure.
But it's been a long time.
Yes.
Well, maybe we could start out by saying that I've been lurking in the columns of the Society for Participatory Medicine for about a month or so. And I see that you contribute quite a lot to the various threads that come through, and I enjoy what you comment on. And I was wondering if you could maybe start off the discussion by telling us how you got involved in this area and how you met Ronnie.
Sure. So in 1989, my pregnant wife got an extremely dangerous cardiac condition while she was pregnant, which resulted, she was at the extreme risk of sudden death. That's how serious the problem was. It's a miracle of great medicine and great doctors that she survived and that I had my wife and a child. This was followed 3 months later by two open-heart surgeries. And doctors told me when the first surgery failed and they had to go back a week later, and then the surgeon said, you have to be aware that your wife is alive, certainly because of your work as a bridge between all of us doctors and the patient. I had spent 2 weeks in medical library to read everything I could read about her condition, and I'd become one of those micro-experts that needed to know everything that had been written about that condition so that I wouldn't have a surprise when news would come.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 1989, the public internet was not existing. 7 years later, she got diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer, and by the time I was already working full-time on the internet. And within 2 hours, I found enough information via one of the very early online communities for cancer patients to call back the surgeon and tell that surgeon that there would be no surgery the next day and that we were going immediately for a second opinion because something just didn't jive.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of which, my wife never had the mastectomy that first surgeon wanted to do. She never had chemotherapy that would have been completely useless in her case. She never got chemo-induced menopause at the age of 40 that for sure she would have gotten if she had received that chemotherapy, and many more side effects that she never experienced because her treatment ended up being much lighter than what the first surgeon proposed. And that experience convinced me that it was time to organize all the existing online communities for cancer conversation. There were three at the time. And when nothing was archived, so the first step was to archive everything.
Uh-huh.
And then within a year, we created a nonprofit, out of which we created over 165 online communities for every type of cancer.
Wow. Quite an accomplishment. That's phenomenal.
The accomplishment is in great part due to the members of every one of those communities. When I created the organization, I promise you, I was not thinking of micro experts. It's only of what the power of, the transformative power of the network. It has taken years to figure out, what is really its impact, and it's just incredible. The world is full of very smart people, and when you are diagnosed with cancer and you are a very smart person, you join many others that are very smart, and the combined power of 1,000 smart people is absolutely mind-boggling.
Well, that's terrific. By the way, just as an aside, the condition that was your wife had when she was pregnant, that wasn't spontaneous coronary artery dissection, was it?
No, she had the worst ever case reported of a condition called WPW, Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome.
Oh, okay.
And
the reason I bring that up is because on one of the discussion groups in the participatory medicine online group was talking about patient-initiated research.
Yes.
And that's the first time that I ever contributed anything because I was aware of one woman who started an online support group for that condition, spontaneous coronary artery dissection.
Sure.
And out of that came research protocols to try to identify how to treat it because it was so rare. And all of the gathering of data was done online. So they created like a virtual, registry for that disease. And it shows the power of one person, or N equals one, and what one person can do. It was just striking.
So let me give you another example, because in reality there are hundreds of those examples that have been taking place now for close to 20 years, except that no one ever hears about it because most of the examples happen in communities that are for privacy purposes, hidden from the rest of the internet. And so if you're not a member, you will never know what the community is doing. And it's really unfortunate because the world would really greatly benefit from having a map of what a, of what patient-driven research is being conducted. It's much bigger than what most people realize. So let me give you another example that could not happen without the power of the network. In the early years of 2000, I think it's 2002, a system engineer and a social worker decided, suffering from a very rare type of cancer, decided to work together because they realized that unless they they helped to create a centralized tissue bank for their disease, there would never be enough material for science to move forward. Mm-hmm. And the system engineer then went on PubMed, and as an engineer, he designed a kind of algorithm to figure out who was the young and most published pathologist who had published the most about their disease. Found that person, contacted him. The group of patients, which is about 1,000, raised, I think, close to $500,000 so that they could fund the work of this young pathologist. A lawyer got involved and created all kinds of legal documents so that every patient could go back to every hospital where their tumors had been excised, so that they could demand a request and obtain some tissue samples to be sent to that centralized tissue bank. And the result of it, of that early work, is that in a few months, a phase one clinical trial will start because, thanks to that research, they think that they have found one of the reasons why this type of cancer develops.
Wow. That's fantastic. I'm sure you have many hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of this. And to be honest about it, I wasn't aware that there was so much information that was patient-generated. You know,
sure. Patient-driven research is for real.
It's really mind-boggling. So how did this lead to smart patients?
So if you think of oncology, when we started this old system of online communities, if you had breast cancer, you just had breast cancer. If you had colon cancer, you had colon cancer. Not quite so today. If you have melanoma, it would be almost criminal to treat you without trying to figure out if you have if you are BRAF positive or not.
Right.
If we don't know, if we don't test you for some markers, almost certainly you are going to receive suboptimal care. So
right.
In reality, it's really, if you have to join a silo, which is a melanoma community, you're only going to learn what people that belong to this melanoma community know. If we provide you the tools so that you can learn both from that melanoma community plus from anybody who is dealing with a BRAF mutation, then your chance of discovering information that could save your life are increasing almost exponentially. And that's the basis of smart patients. We want to take down all possible silos.
Okay? I see.
And so, because oncology is fast turning into molecular oncology, it makes perfect sense to try to bring down all possible silos.
Okay.
I remember we started a community in 98, I think, for people that were suffering from a misdiagnosed disease. Every single one of them, when we started the community, had been misdiagnosed. All the members of this community for a new disease called gastrointestinal stromal tumor, GIST,
right,
had been diagnosed originally with leiomyosarcoma, totally different disease. And because they were misdiagnosed, they were treated for a disease they didn't have, their life expectancy was less than 8 months. All of a sudden, there was a biomarker, because it was known that this new disease, GIST, was associated in almost every case with a c-kit mutation. So the people were told to go back to their doctor and make sure that they were tested to see if they were c-kit positive. Every one of the people that were c-kit positive suddenly had the ability to receive the first targeted treatment, and many of them are still alive today. And what I've discovered since, I discovered this 4 or 5 years ago, is that we now know people with this c-kit mutation with more than 40 different types of cancer. Those are small population of people for every type of cancer, but they all have this c-kit mutation, and most of them will respond to that same targeted therapy. And that is, I mean, that story is really what opened my eyes, and I said we have to develop a new system that is really going to help people find information in ways that are impossible today.
Gilles, this is Greg. Let me ask you a question. So you have an extensive history via ACOR of essentially stewarding site-specific conversations in oncology around tumor type. And now we morph somewhat into a more interactive, more dynamic, seamless conversational opportunities through smart patients, if I'm hearing you correctly. Talk a little bit about how that happens. What's the mechanism to de-silo the silos? Because they're not just patient silos. There's hyper specialization silos out there on the provider side. So how does the integration effectively work?
So when you join smart patients, you're going to be asked to which disease is of most significance to you. And so you will have one tag associated with you, which is the tag of your disease. If you are a newbie or someone who doesn't know how to navigate this kind of site, you will just start to receive every conversation that relates, let's say, to kidney cancer. As you grow better at your understanding of how the site works, you'll start to notice that every conversation has, besides the tag kidney cancer, other tags, either the name of the drug, the name of a mutation, or any other topic that may be of interest to the people that have started the conversation. You can then say, I'm interested in this tag, and I want to follow it. So you now, your doctor has told you that you need to get treatment with, let's say, Sutent. So you now have two tags that you're going to follow, kidney cancer and Sutent. And by doing this, you are going to get all the information about Sutent from the people that have kidney cancer, but also from people from many other communities where Sutent is already used as a treatment for different types of cancer. And the way FDA approval works, the first approval for a drug is always specifically for a disease. And then usually after a few years, the company will apply for that same agent for a different type, different disease. So if you are a member of the community for the second disease, let's say, let's take a case of Votrient, another drug that is used for kidney cancer. Votrient has been approved for kidney cancer many years ago. Votrient has now also been approved for leiomyosarcoma. And so in the leiomyosarcoma, you have a growing number of people that are taking Votrient and are asking questions about the side effects. The pool of knowledge that they can, from the old, if they use the old system, the pool of knowledge they can get is only from members of that leiomyosarcoma community. With smart patients now, the pool will include all the people from the kidney cancer community that have been using Votrient and that are following the Votrient tag. And that changes completely the ability of people to get a lot of information. A lot of information that can transform their quality of life or keep them alive.
So one of the inherent problems around clinical trials, besides it being another stovepipe or silo of sorts, is recruitment into trials. Would this be more of a one way to aggregate with a high degree of sensitivity and specificity patients in the community who might be suitable for specific trials?
Clinical trial accrual recruitment is something that may happen via smart patients, but this is not the core of what we are doing now. On the other hand, access to information regarding clinical trials is completely at the core of what we are doing. And smart patients, besides having the communication platform, has a fully developed clinical trial search engine that is going to become more and more integrated with the communication platform that we have. And so when you are looking for clinical trials that may be good for you, and if you find a clinical trial that seems interesting to you, you will soon be able to see all the conversations that have taken place about that trial. And that is something that you cannot find anywhere else today.
Yeah, I was just wondering about couldn't, and dropping back and listening to what you're saying, you could see where maybe some people might be information overloaded. I was just wondering, you know,
sure.
I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate. Like,
of course. So this is a conversation I've been having for the last 17 years. It's a conversation we'll keep on having. So when we started, the National Cancer Institute decided remarkably to open PDQ statements and put them online, both the PDQ statements that are designed for clinicians and for patients.
Right.
And many people were screaming, saying this is criminal. How can you let patients get access to the PDQ statements for clinicians? Patients are unable to understand this, and they're going to make, like, bad decisions.
No, I wasn't looking at it from that point of view. I was just wondering if, it's some people, not everybody, but some people might be just overwhelmed by the amount of information.
Sure. So
yeah.
Remember what I said: when the new people join, they're going to follow one single tag.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be no pressure for them to add any more tags.
I see.
For the people that join this system and who are information hungry, and many of them are, then the system will allow them to learn as much as they want.
Okay.
So Gilles, walk us through an example of that. Could you walk us through, let's say, would a tag be breast cancer, or would there be some more specificity to that? And if breast cancer is a tag, walk us through how a community would develop around that tag.
So, one of the tags could be breast cancer, and anybody who is interested in breast cancer will follow the conversation with the tag breast cancer. As the community grows, it's quite sure that just as happened with the ACOR communities over the years, a sub-types of breast cancers will decide that they want to have their own tag and basically their own conversations. If you have become a micro-expert in, let's say, DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, you are probably not very interested in following conversation about stage 4 breast cancer. And so the tag breast cancer may not be the best tag for you at that point. Although as a newcomer, you may be interested in following all the conversation at the beginning that relates to breast cancer. So it's going to be there. It's very easy for people to subscribe to a tag, to follow a tag, or unfollow it. It's really a single click. And I always believe that most people are smart enough to find their way around and get just the right amount of information that they want. Remember that over 1 million people have used ACOR for the last 17 years. So I think that we have a pretty good clue of how people use online communities.
Yeah, that's more understandable now. Yeah, I mean, when you're putting it in the hands of the patient and you're not force-feeding them, you know, I think that makes all the difference in the world.
Sure. You remember that all my contributions on the SPM forum or listservs are always about patient-centric medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe that in 2013 you can have high-quality medicine if it is not fully patient-centric.
Right.
Gilles, take a moment and offer your definition of patient-centric, because as one who occasionally pays attention to that listserv, there's perhaps not a standard definition, and there's a different take from based on who you're speaking with, but give us your sense of what you mean by patient-centric medicine.
Well, what I do not mean for sure is patient-centered medicine, which is a buzzword that at this point means very little. I think that in most cases, patient-centered medicine is a term used by the professional health system to avoid having to go through the major changes that are required to get higher quality. When I speak of patient-centric medicine, I speak of having the patient always at the center of the decision-making, which means that the patient must have, and when I say patients, it's patients and caregivers. We make no difference between the two. In order to be in charge of all decisions, you need to be informed at the same level than any health professional is going to be informed. That's what patient-centric medicine is.
And we're coming up on 2 minutes for the live portion of the show. I hope you can stay on for a little bit in overtime, but what are some of the obstacles that you see right now in the way of putting the patient in the conversation in as a principal, if you will, and not a passive observer, but a principal in their own care process? What's top of mind for you there in terms of obstacles?
So honestly, I don't see obstacles. If you provide the right tools to people, they'll use those tools and they become informed and engaged. It is fairly easy for people to understand by just following the conversation between informed, engaged, smart patients. It is very easy for many of them to understand that that's the way to go. And it's very easy for them to raise their level of health literacy in a matter of weeks so that they can become fully active members of those conversations. And I'm delighted to tell you that since we have 30 seconds left, Ronnie, just join us.
We've only got five people at the company, and we gotta divvy up the work.
Well, we will definitely go into overtime, folks. So we'll just start the wind down of at least the live portion of the show. It records and archives end to end for rebroadcast. But we have been speaking with Gilles Friedman, who is the founder of ACOR, ACOR.org, also co-founder of a new venture with Dr. Ronnie Zeiger, smartpatients.com. We've been hearing about the genesis of the organization, and we will continue on into our overtime session. This is Greg Masters, co-hosting for Dr. Richard Just on This Week in Oncology. And next week, join us. We have preliminarily secured the possible participation of Dr. Douglas Blaney, who wrote an incredible piece about the huddles and tumor boards and their effectiveness. So this is Greg Masters signing it off. Stay with us in overtime. Okay, folks, trying to manage that transition. I think we've done it. Welcome, Ronnie.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Ronnie.
Well, thanks for coming back. So, Gilles, you say no obstacles, but when you think about the role of health literacy and something I think which goes to the heart of the Smart Patients mission, there's a Grand Canyon, and it's not just a digital divide. There's a paternalism out there. When I referred to the silos earlier, there's a paternalism out there that's seated rather deep into the provider DNA. And I think that is a definite obstacle. I'm wondering why you think that's not as material of making this happen. Why don't you share some thoughts there?
I'm going to answer this. Again, 17 years of experience have shown that if you provide simple communication tools to people and give them the ability to communicate in a safe environment when they are diagnosed with diseases that are as deadly as cancer, they will learn how to communicate about their disease, about the treatments. We have seen how people within a matter of 2-3 weeks can learn to communicate with terms that were completely foreign to them before.
There's also an unsung hero in this, and that's the role of the translators. And we see translators emerge in all the successful communities. And what happens is that there's the geek patient who is actually attending the ASCO meetings and reporting back in real time about the abstracts he's seeing presented. And then there's another set of patients who sees that and summarizes it for the people who maybe are newer and haven't caught up with the very scientific language. And so there's this dynamic, fluid conversation that happens among different subsets of the community where some of the key things are made possible by the translators who understand all the science and sometimes re-explain it in a slightly less technical way.
Well, that makes sense. So what you're saying is what I'm familiar with is, and I've been practicing oncology for 38 years, is the proliferation of people who, not through a community like you're putting together, but who go to the internet. I guess you call them the geeks, and they download everything in sight, and they come into the doctor's office with a pile of papers, most of it incorrect for their diagnosis. And I think that's part of the obstacles that Greg is talking about comes from providers who day after day are inundated with these requests, like, in your spare time, would you just take a look at this and tell me what applies to me? And that's been the past history of patients interacting with the internet and with their physicians. What you're talking about is a total sea change in that interaction, and actually putting the patients in the center of the discussion and decision making where they should have been all the time, and giving them tools to gather this information. And then they become more intelligent in the discussion with their physicians. But I think that some of the backlash that still may be going on, I'm not sure.
Sure.
But the some of the backlash is from this prior experience.
So what you are discussing, those patients that, like, print reams of papers and go to the doctors, are not what I call informed patients. They are people that just go to Google and download everything they can read about a condition without having the ability to assess if any one of those documents is of any value to them.
Right.
Those online communities are of a very different nature. I look at them as a different form of peer-reviewed publication. People bring concepts all the time, and when the concepts are bad, you can be sure that within a very short period of time, someone is going to say, what you just said doesn't quite fit with what we know. Can you please provide a scientific reference for what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, they filter completely what the patients are going to take to their doctors.
Right.
And having, as a result of which, they're going to have very smart conversation with their doctors who love to have this kind of conversation with their patients.
That's absolutely correct. So I agree with you 100%.
So would it be fair to say, Ronnie and Gilles, that multifaceted as it is, smart patients comes down to essentially a health literacy play to better enable more effective communications in a patient's care process with his or her care team? Is that at the heart here, or is it understating it?
No, you're right, except your question is a little bit paternalistic, says your fellow doctor. I think
is this Dr. Zeiger and not Shields?
This is Dr. Zeiger, who's been taking notes in his couple of years of learning with Gilles.
That's great.
So right. your question is right. We are absolutely talking about health literacy. The piece of your question, which I think is interesting, and I suffer from your same illness, is that we still believe sort of healthcare providers or other members of the traditional healthcare system that the fundamental interaction that we're supposed to have with patients is that expertise is supposed to flow from us to the patient.
Right.
And that's how we often wish it would be, and that's how patients often wish it would be. But medicine and science is getting too complicated too fast. And, of course, mm-hmm. there are exceptions of centers of excellence where individual clinician scientists can focus 100% on a relatively narrow area. But most of us practice in the less academic settings where it's unrealistic for us to be as on top of the science as a networked group of unbelievably motivated patients and caregivers. It doesn't mean that any one of them understands the nuances and are going to be, you know, prescribing drugs or making sure the kidneys don't get boxed by the potentially nephrotoxic chemo. But when it comes to understanding key decisions that need to be made and what information needs to be taken into account, there's a tremendous amount, especially the late-breaking information, there's a tremendous amount that we can learn from the patients and caregivers, again, especially if they're networked, because then they're learning from each other. So this is about literacy, but it's not just about literacy so that the patient can have a higher literacy when he or she engages with a clinician, but it's higher literacy to inform the set of conversations that is happening among patients, caregivers, and clinicians to collaborate together to help provide better care.
And I just want to add one sentence. I think that health literacy is just a side effect of what those platforms do. I look at Smart Patients as a knowledge discovery platform. And when you're a member of it and you just read and discover together with many others what, like, those micro experts are going to write about any topic, if you do this on a daily basis, your health literacy is going to rise significantly and very fast.
Well, unless, Rich, you have some final questions, that's going to have to be the last word. We do have sort of abrupt terminations on Block Talk Radio in the overtime segment. They don't tip their hat when they're going to shut us down. So there you have it. Rich, any last thoughts?
Well, I'd just like to thank Ronnie and Gilles for coming on at the last minute, and it was a fascinating discussion, and I think that Smart Patients is going to be a resounding success.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to echo my sentiments. Your work, Jules, with ACOR has been phenomenal. Your work, Ronnie, with Google Health, launching that, and now working with Jules on Smart Patients is phenomenal. I'm with you there. I hope I didn't sound contrarian. Thank you for your time, and I want to thank our guests, Dr. Ronnie Zeiger and Jules Friedman from Smart Patients. Check it out, smartpatients.com. And we will resume our broadcasting next week on This Week in Oncology with, hopefully, Dr. Doug Laney from Stanford. Thanks again, everybody. Greg Master saying bye now.
Bye.
I'm gonna try and see if they're available to Skype.